Crossroads, go ahead and have your seats. And if you want to grab your Bible and turn over to Proverbs chapter 20. And we have been served so well in the last couple of weeks by both Riley and Matt as we have continued in our series in the book of Proverbs. And this morning we come to Proverbs chapter number 20. Proverbs chapter number 20. As you're finding your way there, I don't know if you are a theme park person. If you're into theme parks, I guess living in Southern California, theme parks are kind of a staple. I think we have kind of sampled them all. We've done Legoland, and we've got the advice of the Ings, who have mastered Legoland. And we have done Disneyland, and that has been mastered by the Williams. And both families are able to give us the way to navigate through the park and how to, all the hacks and the cheats to get through. And then, the best of all, we have done Six Flags. Six Flags, that theme park where the annual pass is cheaper than an one-time entry. I don't know how they do it, but we have been to all of those theme parks. Maybe you're a theme park person, and you'll no doubt have your favorite attraction that you go on. I don't know if this attraction exists in any of the ones in California, but has anybody ever been to a House of Mirrors? House of Mirrors. Yeah, we have a few people. So you know what a House of Mirrors is, right? They're usually at theme parks or attractions, and it's a building where you walk in, and immediately you're disorientated. You're met with all these different kinds of mirrors that give you distorted reflections of yourself and your surroundings. Those mirrors that stretch you. There's those that shrink you. There are those that make you look 500 pounds. There's those that make you vanish. And they flip reality. They distort reality. And if you spend any kind of time, extended time in one of those attractions, you become disorientated. You get a twisted view of reality. And it's easy in those maze-like buildings to get lost. The world in which you and I live is like a house of mirrors. As you look around and as you interact and as you live in this world, you get a view of distorted reality. Things can look a certain way and they can begin to frame our thinking in a way that's not accurate. You can begin to have a warped perspective of what life is really about. It can be disorienting to try and figure out how to walk in this world. Last week, Matt provided us a great framework in Proverbs 19 for how to navigate living in a world that opposes God. And we have seen already that sometimes the Proverbs, they're thematic. In one chapter, like Riley had, covers a subject like the tongue or whatever. But then there's chapters like Matt's and mine, which are just simply observations of the way the world is. Whether we like it or not, the Solomon isn't making a judgment. He's just simply observing the way the world is. Matt told us how the world works. He then showed us the way that God works in that world. And then he closed with the way that wisdom works, the wisdom given by God. And wisdom has been given for us to navigate this house of mirrors, to know what reality is, to know what's truly valuable, to see things as God really sees them. As we come to Proverbs chapter 20, it's simply a continuation of chapter 19. But the points turn extremely practical. You see, you and I need to know what's real in order to know what's right. And Solomon presents objective, standard, unchanging, unfading, timeless, and true realities that will help you and I walk in this world. I've simply called the message today, Right Living in a Wrong World. And I know that that title could be applied to so many of these chapters, but that's what the continuation is as we come to chapter 20, Right Living in a Wrong World. How do we live rightly in a world that's so distorted and trying to distort us? We're going to look at five practical ways to live right in a wrong world. Now, it's 30 verses. We're not going to touch every verse, nor are we going to even read all 30 verses. But rather, what we're going to do is read the first five verses. Because in those opening five verses, Solomon attaches in each one of those a different way to live right in a wrong world. So let's look at it together, just the first five verses, and we'll use each one of these verses as a springboard into other verses throughout the chapter. Verse 1. Wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. The terror of a king is like the growling of a lion. Whoever provokes him to anger forfeits his life. It is an honor for a man to keep aloof from strife, but every fool will be quarreling. The sluggard does not plow in the autumn. He will seek at harvest and have nothing. The purpose in a man's heart is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. Amen. This is God's very word given for us. Five practical ways to live right in a wrong world. The first one that we see in verse number one is we are encouraged to exercise vigilance. Exercise vigilance. Now, what does it mean to be vigilant? Well, when you see the president arrive into any city, you'll see that he's accompanied by a number of Secret Service officers. And their role is to be the eyes of the president. And they often see things that we don't. They come weeks in advance and they scope out the area that he's going to be in, and they look at the buildings all around and they look for dangers. And then on the day that the president arrives, they stand at his side, and if you watch them, they're constantly looking around. They're being vigilant. They're looking for threats. They're looking for targets. They're looking for those who could launch something on the president's life. And they're always looking. And throughout the Proverbs and throughout this chapter, Solomon encourages us to exercise vigilance because there are any number of things that are seeking to take us off the path of wisdom. The first one that we see here in verse 1 is alcohol. Solomon writes, wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. Solomon calls us to be vigilant of excessive indulgence. Now here in this verse, it's not so much an assessment of alcohol that's in view, but rather an abuse of alcohol. Here, alcohol is personified. It's called a mocker, and it's called a brawler. And what Solomon is seeking to show us is the folly of overindulgence. That little phrase, led astray, it's a euphemism, and it literally means to lose one's ability to walk straight. It's simply a term for getting drunk. Let's put that in there. Wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever gets drunk by it is not wise. Solomon shows how that That when someone is led away, when someone overindulges in alcohol, when someone gets drunk, they're no longer in control of their lives. And how many people have made a train wreck of their lives when they were drunk? Head-on collisions, get into fights, make a mockery of themselves. They do something in a moment of drunkenness that can literally ruin their lives. And the reason for that is quite simply because they allowed it to take them captive. They allowed it to lead them astray. They didn't exercise vigilance. They just kept drinking with no thought of the consequences. You know, drunkenness is never presented in a positive light in God's word. Every time that drunkenness is found, it's always with some kind of negative connotations. And I know that you guys are in college, and maybe this is something to your shame, perhaps, that you have been involved with, or you've gotten drunk, or maybe it's something that you don't have much of a conscience about. I don't know where you are in this particular issue. But there's nothing cool about getting drunk. It's always attached to foolishness. Countless people will make a train wreck of their lives, and the reality is drunkenness and godliness, they're antithetical. They're antithetical. Why? Because we're not to be controlled by anything that takes control of our lives. If you come over to Ephesians chapter number 5, I'm sure you already know these verses, but Ephesians and chapter number 5, Paul addresses this exact issue. Ephesians chapter number 5, verses 15 through 18. And he's speaking about our walk, how we walk in this world. And look at what he says in Ephesians 5, verse 15. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise. How proverbial. Making the best use of the time, because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. And do not get drunk with wine, for that is debauchery, but be filled with the Spirit. And really what Paul is saying there is, as you look at your life, there should be nothing controlling your life other than the Spirit of God. Now, as we come back to Proverbs, and we think about exercising vigilance in the realm of excessive indulgence, you might be sitting here this morning and you're maybe saying, well, I never drink, so this doesn't apply to me. Okay. Solomon isn't just setting out a principle about alcohol. There's something more here. There's something bigger. I want to suggest to you guys this morning, there's 100 things that could lead you astray from God through excessive indulgence. Things that God gives for good that can be overused and abused for bad. What are some of those? Money. Constant pursuit of money. God can be replaced in our lives by the god of money, materials, constantly indulging and overindulging and buying and buying and buying and having the latest thing to the point where you're being led astray. What about sex? The thing that God gave as good in the beginning to be enjoyed in the bounds of marriage. And so quickly it's abused, and it can lead you astray, and it can take you captive. What about sitting in your room playing Fortnite? Not for 1 hour or 2 hours, but for 10 hours or 11 hours. And what does it do? It leads you off the path of wisdom. And I want to encourage you guys this morning, be vigilant about the things in your life that they don't take you and lead you astray. Let nothing carnal capture or control your heart. That's why in Proverbs 4:23 that Solomon calls us to guard our heart with all diligence. Why? Because we can be led astray so easily. And this chapter, we don't only see the need to exercise vigilance in verse 1, but let me just give you another two very quickly. We're to be vigilant in excessive indulgence, but, you know, we have also to be vigilant in making impulsive vows. Impulsive vows. If you look down at verse number 16, it says, "Take a man's garment when he has put up security for a stranger, and hold it in pledge when he puts up security for foreigners." That's a concept that we've met before about being a guarantor. And in particular here, when someone comes along and they ask you to be a guarantor of something, don't just blindly accept it, but be vigilant. What are they asking? Is there a chance you're going to lose everything when you invest in this? Be wise in being a guarantor. Be vigilant. Don't fall for foolish schemes. But also, if you look at verse 25, it is a snare to say rashly it is holy and to reflect only after making vows. Be vigilant in making impulsive vows to God. In the Old Testament, it was a serious thing to make a vow to God, especially if you couldn't keep it. It was seen as a violation of the second commandment. And there's one tragic example of one of the judges in Judges 11:31, a judge named Jephthah, and he's leading Israel in a battle against the Ammonites, and he makes this vow that the next person who comes through my door, I'm going to sacrifice them to the Lord. And he makes this vow, and who's the person that comes through his door? It's his own daughter. And tragically, he has to stick with that vow. And what Solomon is saying, exercise vigilance when you come to making vows, when you come to make promises, are you going to be able to fulfill them? Particularly when they're promises related to the work of God. That's why Jesus in Matthew 5, he says, don't make vows, but just let your yes be yes and your no be no. Guys, I want to encourage you to be careful what you promise to God. Don't make big statements, but exercise vigilance over your words. And a great summary of this point is, or a great antidote, or a great way to stop us doing that is verse 12. Because in verse 12 it says, "The hearing eye, ear, and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both." And the verse tells us that God has made two receptive organs that give you and I the ability to exercise vigilance. How do I exercise vigilance? Well, he's given us ears to hear the truth. As you drink in the truth in a world that's got so much wrong in it, this is our objective standard. Have ears that hear the truth. But God has also given us eyes to exercise discernment. Both are needed to exercise vigilance as you see. And I read an article in Psychology Today that there's a connection between your eyes and your ears. The two actually work together. That what you hear and what you see, there's some way that the two communicate to each other. And as you hear truth and as you look at the world and you look at your life and you bring the two together, that's how you exercise vigilance. And if something doesn't look right, then it probably isn't right. Because if it doesn't align with God's word, then it's definitely not right. And so, don't be like the world that has eyes and ears, and yet they don't hear and see. So verse 1, how to live right in a long world, Solomon says and calls us to exercise vigilance. Don't let anything lead you off the path of wisdom. Secondly, in verse 2, not only do we exercise vigilance, but we have got to expect vengeance. Expect vengeance. Verse 2 introduces us to the king. The terror of a king is like the growling of a lion. Whoever provokes him to anger forfeits his life. We have met the king before in a number of Proverbs, and next week, as Jeremy preaches, we'll meet the king again in chapter 21. Solomon himself, a king, is concerned with government and helping us understand and have a right attitude towards the government. And here, the focus throughout this chapter is on vengeance. What is vengeance? Well, it's simply the righting of wrongs, the upholding of justice, the punishment of wrongdoers. It's of vindication. And in a fool's world, there is no expectation of vengeance. There's no counting the cost of our actions. There's no considering of consequences. And though at times it's delayed, we need to remember that our choices have consequences. We need to be different to the world and count the cost. As Austin, when he was preaching through these Proverbs, often used the little idiom, play stupid games, you win stupid prizes. And that's what we find, and that's an observation that Solomon makes generally in verses 20 and 21, for example. He says, if one curses his father or his mother, his lamp will be put out in utter darkness. And then he says, an inheritance gained hastily in the beginning will not be blessed at the end. And there's two general principles about we live in a world where we should expect vengeance, that if we do wrong, we're most likely going to face some kind of retribution or punishment. However, Solomon, repeatedly throughout chapter 20, notes that vengeance is connected to the king, connected to government, God's chosen instrument to uphold and administer justice. And so whether we agree with our government or not, whether we vote for our government or not, we've got to keep in mind that kings and governments are there for one great purpose, and that's to institute justice. And as we think about that in light of chapter 20, first of all, we have to have a rightful fear of kings. That's what verse 2 is saying. Have a rightful fear of kings. The terror of a king is like a growling lion. The king is personified as a lion. I don't know about you, but as you think about a pet, you probably wouldn't choose a fluffy lion. Maybe you would if you're crazy, but you don't have lions as pets. In fact, I just Googled up yesterday that a lot of people who have lions as pets, do you know what happens to them? Yeah, they don't do the Daniel story very well. Let's just leave it there. They're not pets. You don't provoke a lion. You don't go up to a cage of a lion and try to put your fingers in and try to stroke its nose and say, coochie, coochie, cat. No, that's not a lion. You put your finger in a lion's cage, what's it going to do? It's going to bite you. And the idea here is that we need to have a view of government that you don't play fast and loose with the law. Governments aren't there to be poked at and see how far over the line can I step before I end up in cuffs. We live in a world that doesn't respect law enforcement, doesn't respect the government. But the law isn't there to be broken. This personification of the king as of a lion is to personify authority, that we should have a healthy fear of the law and of breaking it, that if you break the law, then the reality is that there's consequences to that. So think about that. Expect vengeance when you go against the government. It's our duty as believers who honor the Lord to submit to kings and authorities, to have a respect for them and a right reverence for them and the fact that they have been appointed by God. Not only should we have a rightful fear of kings, but if you look down at verse number 8, we should recognize the function of kings. A king who sits on the throne of judgment winnows all evil with his eyes. Verse 26, a wise king winnows the wicked and drives the wheel over them. Now you may look at this and you may sigh, because why? Well, Matt's sermon last week, we live in a world that doesn't work the way God intended. But generally, we've got to recognize the function of kings. It's the government's job to winnow out evil. That's an agricultural term. It's a term that was used for separating separating chaff from grain. And the grain was brought in with the chaff, and the farmer would seek to separate the two. And it's the job of government to separate the innocent from the guilty. Now, why is it important that we recognize the function of government? Here's why: because it's not your job. It's not my job. So many people, and we see the famous movies where there's vigilantes and stuff. That's not what living right in a wrong world is. God has put kings in place to function as those who separate the innocent from the guilty and uphold justice in our world. And so we've got to submit to a sovereign God and trust his process. Which brings us to our third thing as we think about expecting vengeance. We're to have a rightful fear of kings in verse 2 and recognize the function of kings in verses 8 and 26. But listen, guys, and this is so important for you and I as children of God this morning. Remember the fallibility of kings. Verse 22. Do not say, I will repay evil, but wait for the Lord and he'll deliver you. And you're like, I'm trying to have a rightful fear of kings, but when I recognize the function of kings, they're not doing what they're supposed to do. Yeah, because the world's broken. That doesn't mean we become bitter and cynical and anti-authoritarian or all of those things. It means we realize that you and I live in a world that is broken, and that we have leaders that are fallible, and we have corrupt leaders in power, and we live in a world where injustice reigns. But here's the thing, that's only for now. Get to the bigger point of this point. Expect vengeance. Why? Because we have a king. A more terrifying king who sits on a higher throne, whose eyes are in every place, a king of perfect justice who will execute perfect vengeance in his perfect time. You may not have been wrong to the level of needing law enforcement to intervene, but we've all been wronged, right? We've all had people do things on us, and we wonder, why do the wicked prosper? And the worst thing you can do is do so often what the world does, is go rogue and retaliate and take vengeance into your own hands. And this is a principle repeated by Paul in the book of Romans, where he encourages them, don't take vengeance into your own hands. Don't do it, because you'll ruin your own character. But wait and be patient on vengeance. Wait and let the Lord avenge. Wait for the Lord and he will deliver you. Listen, Crossroads, this morning, in a world that's gone wrong, we have a king that's going to make it right. And you can expect vengeance, but it might not be in your timeline. In the meantime, you've got to wait and be faithful and trust the Lord. We are to, as we think about living right in a wrong world, exercise vigilance, expect vengeance. Let's move on to verse number 3. Again, a verse that introduces a series of things that we find throughout the chapter. We are to embellish virtue. We are to embellish virtue. Now, there's a word, embellish. What does that mean? Well, we're at the stage now where we have a 5-year-old daughter who lives for cheer. Rachel said that she had a dream that if she ever had a daughter, she just wanted her to do cheer. And that dream has been realized. We have a daughter who does cheer. I don't understand it. I don't know what it is. They dance around, but apparently it's a lot more skilled than that. Sorry if I've offended anyone who's a cheerleader, right? But Sophia does cheer. And yesterday she had a competition, and I've never seen anything like it, with like hairspray and makeup. Like, she had to wear mascara, and she asked, could she wear it to church today? And we were like, nope, that was for competition only. No. But her little outfit that she wears, it's this crazy, like, orange and black outfit, okay? It's got printed decoration on it, but the printed decoration for a cheer competition isn't enough. It needed to be embellished with like diamonds, except they're like plastic things out of Hobby Lobby, right? But they sparkle. And the thing is, in that world, you got to pop. Okay, her little bow had embellishments, her uniform had embellishments, and it just makes her pop. And that's what embellishment does. And as we think about that, our character should pop in this world. As Christians, we should be embellished with virtues that make us pop in this world. Verse 3 introduces us to the first of several contrastive characteristics. In verse 3, Solomon introduces the honor of peacefulness. He says it is an honor for a man to keep aloof from strife, but every fool will be quarreling. He says, what's honorable in this world? What's one thing that makes you honorable? Well, keep aloof from strife. Now, that, there's a word, to keep aloof. Aloof means to be above. It can be used negatively. Oh, he's so aloof. But here it's being used positively. It means to stay at altitude, to stay above. The Hebrew word in the original literally means to stay absent from, to keep out of something. And what Solomon is saying here is, don't be known as someone who's always stirring strife. We don't only live in a world that's wrong, but we live in a world at war. Everybody is fighting for something. They're fighting for their rights, or they're fighting for this, that, or the other. And Solomon says, what's honorable in this world, a virtue to embellish, is peacefulness. Not when I asked you this morning. Honestly, in your heart, are you someone who's always got beef with someone else? No matter where you go, you can just make enemies. Are you someone who's always fighting about something? I want to help you guys a little bit. Because in the evangelical, conservative Christian world, it's so easy to have a warrior complex. That I've got to debate every disagreement. That I've got to wade into every war. That I've got to right every wrong, and I've got to silence every critic, and I've got to do it all on Twitter. Can I plead with you guys? Don't be that person. Don't be that person. Don't misunderstand, neither I nor Solomon are advocating passivity. There are times the Bible calls us to defend the truth, and you should defend the truth. But we are advocating for peacefulness. Don't be a war maker. Don't be a fight starter. Don't live your life just going through life fighting with every person who disagrees with you. Be known for ending fights and not starting them. Create peace and not war. Bruce Waltke says the wise are more concerned to bring about peace than a desire to be right. But the fool cannot restrain himself, and at first opportunity explodes and shows his teeth. Guys, learn to rise above strife. Honor is found in living peaceably with all men. A pleasing life in God's sight is one according to 1 Timothy 2, that's marked by peacefulness, quietness, godliness, and dignity. Can you write those down? A pleasing life in God's sight is one marked by peacefulness, quietness, godliness, and dignity. 1 Timothy chapter 2. As we think about our character popping in this dark world and the things and the virtues that we should embellish the honor of peacefulness. Let me give you a few more, and there's a ton of them throughout this chapter, and I'm not going to give you them all, but if you just drop down to verse 6, another virtue to embellish is the rarity of faithfulness. Not only the honor of peacefulness, but the rarity of faithfulness. He says in verse 6, many a man proclaims his own steadfast love, but a faithful man who can find. Solomon here isn't setting a contrast between steadfast love and faithfulness, but what he's doing is he's setting a contrast between saying and doing. There's a difference between those who proclaim to have the disposition of steadfast love, but Solomon says, who can find, or it's rare to find one who actually perform faithfulness. And again, it reminds us it's not about who we say we are, but it's who we show ourselves to be. And Solomon says, don't just say that you're a man of steadfast love, but show yourself to be a person of faithfulness, because that's so rare. The honor of peacefulness and the rarity of faithfulness. What about verse 7, the blessing of uprightness? The righteous who walks in his integrity, blessed are his children after him. Here we have the virtue of integrity, and we're told here that integrity adorns the righteous. What's integrity? It means to be upright. It means there's no crookedness in your life. If you walk uprightly, you'll not walk perfectly, but you'll have a compass rooted in the Word of God that helps you to walk upright. It's the walk of Psalm 1. You know, when I first came to seminary, I had no idea about Canvas and taking exams and stuff on Canvas. And some of our professors are really good because they stick a knife in you almost as you start about integrity, because when you open the quiz. And I know a couple of my professors, and they have that verse as question one. And it's like, do you understand this verse? The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding good and evil. I'm like, dang it, okay. I mean, they make sure that all textbooks are put away. But another professor said this to me, because, you know, you take exams and stuff at home. And I never forgot this, and it's stuck with me and will do for every quiz I take on Canvas where it says, don't use any other resources. He said this, it's better to flunk a quiz with your integrity intact than to pass a quiz through cheating and lose it. What a great principle for life. And that's what Solomon is saying here. As you go through life, be marked as a person of integrity. That you won't give up your integrity cheaply. And in verse 7, we're told that integrity can be instilled. He uses parents here, and he basically is saying, is the way a parent lives is the way a child lives. And what a challenge for those in this room who are parents, and for you guys who will be future parents, to instill in your children values like integrity. My children are watching me. But here's the thing, you guys as students, integrity is infectious. And so as you show integrity, you influence other people with that integrity. You challenge them. And I want to encourage you guys this morning, be a model of influential integrity. Social media is full of influencers, and the influence through fashion, and the influence through this, that, and the other. Why not be an influencer of integrity? Very quickly, a couple of others, one more actually. Let me just show you another one. What about the beauty of honestness? As we think of virtues to embellish the honor of peacefulness and the rarity of faithfulness and the blessing of uprightness, verses 10 and 23 and 17 bring before us the beauty of honestness. Verse 10 is repeated again in verse 23. Unequal weights and unequal measures are both alike an abomination to the Lord. This verse, or these two verses, 10 and 23, they show us how serious the Lord is about honestness. This scene is a shop scene. It's the scene of an ancient merchant where they didn't use coins to trade, but they used weights. And those weights could be altered, and a shop owner or a merchant could cheat the system, and they could alter the weights depending on whether they were buying or selling in their favor. And while the person on the receiving end may be none the wiser, the Lord is beholding that transaction, and that dishonesty, it doesn't just say that the Lord dislikes it, but he despises it. He detests it. It's an abomination to the Lord. Verse 17 is a really practical example of this very principle where Solomon says, bread gained by deceit is sweet to a man, but afterward his mouth will be full of gravel. And he says you could trick someone, you could deceive someone into doing something, and you in the immediate reap the benefit, but afterwards, that sweet bread becomes like dirt in your mouth. And the reality is, guys, deceitfulness never prospers. You can deceive everyone around you, but you can't deceive the Lord. And I want you to remember that gain at the expense of your character is never gain. Gain at the expense of your character is never gain. And sin can seem so pleasant for a season, but as we know from Romans, the wages of sin is what? It's death. That's why as we think about embellishing virtues, verse 11 is such a great summary verse. It's also a greatly searching verse, where Solomon says, if even a child makes himself known by his acts, by whether his conduct is pure and upright. What a great summary verse, but what a greatly searching verse. Here, Solomon is using an analogy of a child, and you know, childhood gives a great glimpse of adulthood, of what a you can get a fair idea of what a child's going to be when it grows up, when you see the attitudes that it has and the behaviors that it has. And I know that some of those can be grown out of, but if a child is naturally a trickster, a deceiver, it's a good chance in adulthood it's going to be a trickster, a deceiver. Children make themselves known by their acts. How much more so do adults? And it's a reminder again, guys, that conduct is a true indicator of character. Not what we say we are, but what we show ourselves to be. And you guys in college ministry and in a college season of life, college is a time for developing character that will follow you the rest of your life. You're no longer children. You're now adults, and you're beginning to form worldviews, and you're beginning to set yourself on up for life. And you're beginning to develop a character that will follow you the rest of your life. And I want to encourage you to cultivate a good character now in college. And I want you to search your heart as I have searched mine. And this is hard for me as I thought about this, and I hope it's hard for you. What trajectory is your character on? As you look at your life, what trajectory is your character on? Is your life embellished with virtues or vices? If it's the latter, now is the time to root them out. Begin to make that character of godliness pop now. Begin to live right in a wrong world now by embellishing things like peacefulness and faithfulness and uprightness and honestness. Well, let's move on to verse number 4 as we think about right living in a wrong world. Solomon calls us to exercise vigilance and expect vengeance and embellish virtue. Verse 4, he calls us to exhibit vigor. Exhibit vigor. We are introduced again to the sluggard. The sluggard does not plow in autumn. He will seek at harvest and of nothing. We meet him. He appears throughout the Proverbs continually. And he's used by the Proverbs as a negative. He represents a life of laziness. He's not known for effort or putting in effort in the opportunities that God has given him. He's known for being wasteful with his life. His life just slips away as he sleeps it away, and as he lives in laziness and puts no effort into his life, simply his life has no vigor in it, no get up and go. He's just a layabout, a sluggard. In verse 4, the particular example or the particular area of life that that Solomon uses here is the sluggard, the lazy person who refuses to put effort into sowing. He uses a farming scene. And he talks about a time when a farmer would go out to plow. Now, the plowing process, as it's thought about here, is that process by which the hard ground that has sat dormant for a period of time is broken up and it's dug up and it's churned up and it gets it ready for seeds to plant. Now, it was a hard job. It was a job that involved pulling this wooden contraption that had a metal blade on the front, and you walked behind it and it was pulled by donkeys or oxen, and you would walk up and down and sort of uphill and downhill, and there would be rocks to move out of the way. And so it was an arduous task. It was a task that required vigor. It required energy. It required effort. And beside that, it was done in autumn. Now, that word's a little bit, it leads you astray a little bit, or a little bit misleading. Autumn was a season, a rainy season that was known as the winter season, that stretched from mid-October to April. And it was the prime time for Palestinian farmers to plow their fields. They would wait on the rains coming, and that would help break the ground up. And the conditions were cold, and they were wet, and they were uncomfortable. But it had to be done to produce a harvest. The sluggard doesn't want that effort. The sluggard does the bare minimum. The sluggard doesn't plow in autumn. The idea here is that instead of plowing, he simply comes along and he scatters seed on top. Now, I've tried this. I tried this at home with our grass. We had a garden that the ground wasn't great, and I tried to get more grass to grow, and the one thing I didn't do is I didn't cultivate the soil enough, and I just threw seeds on top, and here's what happens. If you just throw seeds on top of hard ground, you get what? Nothing. You don't get anything. And that's what's happening here. The sluggard comes along and he thinks that he can just bypass the plowing process, doesn't need to put hard work in. He's going to take the lazy man's approach and he's just going to kind of throw seed down and hope for the best. What happens? Harvest comes when everybody else is reaping. What's he doing? Well, it says just very simply, he will seek at harvest and of nothing. The original literally carries the idea he becomes a beggar. All the other farmers that have put the effort in are reaping the rewards of their harvest. He's been lazy and he's got nothing. He expects something and he gets nothing. Here's the simple analogy, guys. A life of laziness will lead to a life of emptiness. A life of laziness leads to a life of emptiness. It's the same idea. Verse 4 corresponds with verse number 13, where Solomon says, "Love not sleep, lest you come to poverty. Open your eyes and you'll have plenty of bread. Verse 13 is the antithesis of verse 12, where we read that the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both. There's nothing wrong with sleep, and I know this is a tough crowd of college students. I was talking to one college student at Canyon, tells me on a Saturday he gets up at 2 p.m. I'm like, I don't know how you sleep that long. Like, the day, what's the point in getting up? The day's actually gone, but hey, whatever. There's nothing wrong with sleep. It's a bit like verse 1. It's not the sleep itself that's in view, but it's oversleeping. It's the abuse of sleep. And it's not even so much even sleep itself. It's the idea of laziness. Missed opportunity leads to poverty. You don't work, you don't eat. That's not fair. That's how life is. That's how God designed life to be. Don't work, don't eat. But we don't live in a world like that anymore. We live in a world that people want to stay home, sponging off mom and dad until they're however old. They don't want to get out and work. Provide for themselves, be independent. Verse 13 is the opposite of verse 12, where we're called to open our eyes, get out of bed, be productive, exercise vigor, actually put effort into the opportunities that God has given you in college. Don't waste these years. Exercise vigor to enjoy life. 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 10 through 12, Paul speaks there of the importance of working with our hands. And I know that work is hard, but work is good. God is a worker, and God has designed us to work. And I want to encourage you guys this morning, don't be lazy with your life. Don't waste college. Don't waste the abilities that God has given you. There's a stewardship that comes with the giftings that God has given. Learn to work hard. You know, Christians should be the best workers in terms of their effort and attitude in all of society. Why? Because of the principle of Colossians 3 and verse 23, we do all things to the glory of Christ. I want to ask you this morning, and this is a challenge, as you look at college and your attitude in college and how you're approaching college, are you approaching it to the glory of God, or could you do more? Do you need to exercise more vigor? And I know that studying calculus, I don't even know what calculus is, all right? I'm just trying to appeal to UCLA. I don't know what calculus is. I don't know what trigonometry is. But hey, if that's your wheelhouse, could you do more? I know it's not fun studying it. But you got to work hard. Because working hard is like that plowing and that sowing, because when the harvest comes, you want to have something to show for the opportunities that God has given you. And I'm not saying that you need to go out and God's only happy when you get a 4.0 GPA. You can honor the Lord with a 2.5 if you've just got the brains for a 2.5 and you work as hard as God has given you the ability to, and you honor Him and you do your best. But here's the thing, if God has given you the brains for a 4.0, but you've wasted your time in college playing Fortnite, hey, is that glorifying the Lord? Guys, learn to exhibit vigor in your lives now in college. Because it sets you in a trajectory for the rest of your life. Well, let's wrap this up this morning. Right living in a wrong world, exercise vigilance, expect vengeance, embellish virtue, exhibit vigor. Very quickly, number 5, evaluate value. Evaluate value. Verse 5, the purpose in a man's heart is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. We live in a world that appraises everything wrong, looks at the world through the wrong lens, with the wrong guidebook. Do you know if you're going to buy a car, you have that book here. We have a different one at home, but the Kelly Blue Book, and you look it up, and you see your car, and you thought it was worth $15,000, and it's worth like $2,500, and you're like, ah, dang it, car's not as good as I thought it was. You appraise things differently depending on how biased or the lens that you look through it. And we live in a world that evaluates things differently the way God does. And so if to live right in this wrong world, we're called to evaluate what's truly valuable, evaluate things differently. And in verse 5, Solomon is calling us to evaluate people and their actual purposes. Verse 5, the word purpose, it refers to our inner motivations, our driving force for action. And the image here is a whale. And what Solomon is saying is often people's purposes, their motivations, they're buried deep under the surface. They're inaccessible. And so often what can happen is what we see on the surface isn't what's happening underneath. And it may not be immediately obvious what someone's motives are, but a wise person doesn't take actions at face values. Now, they're not gullible, but they're discerning by drawing out what someone's true motives are. They scratch a little bit beneath the surface to see what's going on. And Solomon says they draw them out. The idea is of a bucket being lowered into a well and drawing it out. It's seeking to see beneath the surface, looking a bit deeper. It's a call not to be constantly cynical or immediately skeptical of everything and everyone, but wisely evaluating. Don't be a face value Christian, but look a little bit beneath the surface. Evaluate value not only in people and their purposes. In verse 15, wealth and its actual worth. There is gold and abundance of costly stones, but the lips of knowledge are a precious jewel. We live in a world that values wealth. And there's no denying the goodness of wealth, but wisdom and knowledge and ability to apply such is so much more valuable. Evaluate age and its actual advantages. Verse number 29, the glory of young men is their strength, but the splendor of old men is their gray hair. The young in their prime, their glory is their physical strength, but the bodies that we have and the physicality we have when we're young, it fades. And there needs to be more to our lives than muscle. And so the contrast here and the value here is actually to grow old with gray hair. And that gray-headedness is a picture of wisdom that never fades. Verse 30. Evaluate the value of pain and its actual profit. I know I've rushed through those real fast, but time has beat us. But the chapter closes, blows that wound cleanse away evil, strokes make clean the innermost parts. The picture here is corporal punishment and how effective it is in this time. But we can think about suffering and pain. No, suffering seems pleasant in the moment, can't seem valuable. When hardship comes, and that's so different to the world we live in, they don't know what to do. They deconstruct when pain comes. But Hebrews 12:11 tells us that all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. Four examples call us to constantly look beneath the surface and beyond the present and away from the world's valuations and have an eye to what God counts as valuable and actually pursue that. We started in the house of mirrors, and it is so fitting for the world we live in. We live in a world that's so deeply distorted, a world that stretches, shrinks, obscures, and hides what's actually true. We're living here in a world to enjoy, but a world that's wrong, and we need to be vigilant, not sucked into the world system. Spurgeon said this, character is always cost when a high ideal is sacrificed on the altar of conformity and popularity. And that's why we, with God's help, can live rightly in a wrong world. How? Well, I want to encourage you this week to exercise vigilance. Expect vengeance. Embellish virtue. Exhibit vigor. And evaluate value. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the wisdom of your word. We thank you for how practical your word is in helping us live rightly in a wrong world. And we know that this world is wrong today, but we rejoice that one day it will be made right. But until then, Father, will you help us with the Spirit's help to live out wisdom and to walk in a manner that brings glory and honor to your name, because we ask it for Christ's sake. Amen.